The FBI wants to be able to hack your computer anywhere, anytime. Cortana only lets you search Bing. And Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica is here to tell us about his experience with a cyber lady. All that and more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1503, recorded Friday, April 29th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now to take advantage of their Mother's Day sale. It's a limited sale through May 3rd only, and enter promo code TNT for a free color upgrade. Hello, and welcome to Tech News Today, the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is out today for some periodontal surgery. Ooh. But joining us today is Ian Thompson from The Register. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Megan. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for coming. There's lots of great stories that I know you are excited to talk about, so we should get started. Late yesterday, the Supreme Court approved changes that would give the FBI more power over when and where they can access our computers and everybody else's computers everywhere. Ostensibly, the charges are designed to help the FBI combat offshore botnets. But Ian, you say this change is pretty nefarious and it's something we want to pay attention to.
Well, basically, this gives the FBI or law enforcement in the U.S. the ability to hack any computer anywhere in the world, pretty much wherever they like, just by going to one judge and obtaining a warrant for it. It's a fairly egregious thing to try and push through as an administrative rule change. I mean, Congress hasn't debated this. There's been no public consultation. All the tech firms are against it. Civil libertarians are against it. Even some politicians are against it. Senator Ron Wyden is actually coming out and saying he'll definitely introduce legislation to stop this. Now, we've got until December the 1st before the new rule kicks in. But if it does, it's going to, A, be a very big piece of overreach on behalf of law enforcement, but it's really going to hurt America in the eyes of the rest of the world as well, because basically it's saying, if we get one warrant, then that's it. All your computers belong to us.
So right now, if someone is using a Tor browser or something and nobody knows where they are, whose jurisdiction is it?
Well, this is what the rule change is meant to sort out. Ideally, they should actually find out where these people are and then issue warrants in that particular locality. Now, this whole case was brought to light with the Playpen investigation by the FBI, where a site hosting images of child abuse was they seized the servers of and ran the site themselves for 2 weeks. And then put network investigative techniques, as they call it, which we suspect is a malware plugin, into their computers and identified individual people. Now, technically, they should have got a warrant for where those individual people were, but they didn't know where they were at the time. So on one level, something's got to change, but doing it by an administrative rule change just is fundamentally undemocratic and very dangerous.
So, I mean, this would let the U.S. give the U.S. jurisdiction anywhere?
Absolutely anywhere, yeah. I mean, it's basically they would get one warrant, which, and wherever the computers are, they could be able to get into them. And crucially as well, it gives the FBI, or gives law enforcement, the right to hack into people's computers who are themselves the victims of hacking. Now, this is billed as a botnet measure, an anti-botnet measure to actually find out where the command and control servers are. But at the same time, again, it's a massive amount of overreach for what is essentially a fairly simple problem.
So, yeah, that was what Wyden wrote on his blog about that it treats the victim like the criminal. So what you're saying is, like, if you haven't done any of your updates and your computer is being used as a zombie for this botnet, this would say that the government would be able to search your computer as well?
Yes, indeed. They'd be able to search for evidence related to the criminals who are actually putting it on there. What isn't made clear, and this is why we need a reasoned debate about this, is if they did that and they found other material which was deemed to be illegal, would the person then be able to be charged? under the rules as they stand at the moment, it appears that they would be. But because this is phrased in a very broad way, there's no real way of finding that out until the first cases come to court, and then the precedent, legal precedent has to be built up. So this is why we need a proper debate on it, because at the moment, as it stands, the language is so broad that it could really open the door to a whole variety of tricks, which really law enforcement shouldn't have the ability to get just on the basis of a rule change. This needs politicians elected by the people to actually argue it through and craft something which is usable within the real world.
So all this sounds crazy to me. Why do you think this isn't getting more attention? Is it because it's just early days, or is it because it's not as flashy as like the Apple versus the FBI? Why aren't we hearing more about this?
Well, it's a long process. The Justice Department has been mulling these changes for 3 years. And it's only yesterday that the Supreme Court decided, yep, okay, we can sign off on this, and then sent it back to Congress. So this is the beginning of basically a campaign that's going to last, as I say, until December the 1st when the changes come into effect. So it's been bubbling under. We've been discussing it on and off on the site. But it was a very slow burner, as I say, 3 years in the making. And then all of a sudden the Supreme Court came out and said, yep, okay, we can approve this. Started the process going, and now people are really starting to realize that this could be a major problem going forward.
So there's nothing really to do until December 1st?
Well, there's a lot to do before December 1st. There's basically getting in contact with politicians, getting them organized about this, having a proper debate, and coming up with a law which would give, would be a reasoned law which would allow, a reasonable amount of hacking under judicial supervision. As it stands at the moment, it just takes one judge and that's it. That's the whole ballgame. I think what we need to do is actually look at this in a more reasoned way and say exactly what powers the government has before they're hacking into people's computers. Because from an individual level, it's bad, but from a corporate level as well, this opens up companies, both in America and overseas, to potentially a very serious problem. Because if the FBI, if one of their machines gets infected, law enforcement could then legally, under US law, go in there, and that opens them up to liability in ways which is going to make a lot of lawyers very fat and happy, but is going to make the rest of us in a much more precarious position.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on. According to a post on the Microsoft blog, Cortana will no longer search Google for you or any other third-party search engines that you might want to use. She insists that you use Bing. Thank you very much. So what do you think about this? I mean, this is basically what Microsoft is saying. They want an integrated search experience. So if Cortana is really going to be the digital assistant that you want her to be, you have to search only using Bing. And nothing else, so that she can help you the way you want her to help you.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty much about as blatant as it gets when you're talking about trying to lock people into your services. I mean, logically, if you think it through, if you really want a digital assistant which knows everything, then it should be able to search multiple search engines so to get the best results out of all of them. But no, you're going to have to Bing it, to use Microsoft's phrase. And they actually use that phrase in Hawaii 5.0. I don't know how much Microsoft paid them to do it, but it's a crushingly hilarious and shameful inducing thing. But it's basically Microsoft doing what it's done traditionally, which is trying to lock customers into their particular products and services. I don't suppose there's anything illegal about it, but it does leave a rather bad taste in the mouth.
Yeah, especially considering their history. I mean, there were workarounds before, I guess. I mean, it was designed to lead you to Bing, but there were workarounds, and now they've blocked them. So I guess we'll see. But it's interesting because it seems like not like the new Microsoft that we've been hearing about. And especially even today, I mean, they released a new tool called Flow, and that claims to make it easy to mash up two or more different services. The service is live now, too. It seems exactly opposite of what they were saying with not being able to use anything besides Cortana. This Flow is like if this, then that. If you use that, it just, the recipes of IFTTT, it looks exactly like it, more for work. But, it uses Microsoft products mostly, but also works with Twitter and some other services. Don't you think this is counterintuitive to the other announcement they made today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the classic example of the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. On the one hand, you've got Microsoft getting very into open source, cloud, getting itself everywhere, opening itself up to new services. And the Flow tool, as you say, very handy in a lot of ways. But there's still that feeling that, you know, we must try and lock people in as much as possible to our side of things in order to maximize revenue, which is perfectly understandable, as I say. But the two are rather in opposition to each other. I think we're going to see Microsoft is changing very rapidly as a company, and they are trying to open up, and they are trying to get into open source and get into sharing and the rest of it. But, you know, it's like the dinosaur brain. There's still a vestigial tail brain out there going, all ours, don't let anyone else out. You know, I mean, it's the kind of thinking that got them such heavy fines and the threat of breakup for the Internet Explorer debacle.
But, yeah.
You know, it's the way a lot of companies work. And certainly Microsoft has been better at it than most of them.
Well, the United States Air Force just awarded Elon Musk's SpaceX an $87.2 million contract for a GPS satellite launch. Military space launches like this were previously given to the United Launch Alliance, a partnership between Lockheed Martin and Boeing. The head of the Air Force's Space and Missile Systems Center said SpaceX came in at about 40% cheaper than the UAL. You wrote about this today on the Register. What can you tell us about it?
Oh, well, this is a classic example of government pork actually falling to a bit of competition, and we're all going to benefit as a result. I mean, the United Launch Alliance for the last 10 years has been providing U.S. government military launches for a whopping fee, it's got to be said. I mean, $125 million per launch. That rises to about $200 million if you take into account the contingency contract payments that the government was making, so they could be sure they could always have a booster ready for launch. And these were using Russian rockets. They weren't even American-built stuff. SpaceX actually had to sue to get access to this market because ULA had got it locked down so tight. And they're managing to, you know, instead of $125 million, they're willing to do it for $82. And those prices will fall as well if they get their reusable rocket system going up and running very quickly. A senior ULA executive was actually fired or asked to resign a couple of months ago when he inadvertently told the truth to a bunch of students about what was going on. ULA didn't bid on this contract, not because they couldn't do the job, but because they couldn't match SpaceX's price and they didn't want to draw attention to that. He said that in public and then was shown the door very, very quickly, put it that way. It's pity because he was a very good engineer, but, you know, I mean, it's just, you can't have monopolies. They're ultimately unproductive. And a bit of healthy competition here has saved us all quite a bit of cash.
Yeah, exactly. So these are, what kind of satellite? Are these spy satellites that we're talking about?
No, GPS.
Okay.
I mean, the next generation of GPS satellites now need to go up because you've got to keep up a fairly steady cadence of GPS satellites going into orbit in order for the whole thing to work. Also, GPS has got increased competition from Galileo in the UK, in the EU. The Russian Glasnost system is going up, global positioning system is adding more satellites, and the Chinese are building their own network as well. So the GPS satellites need to be constantly updated, they need new abilities. This is basically SpaceX just getting a tiny little piece of the pie, firing up the next GPS satellite on the cheap, and as a result, we all know where to go when we're driving.
Thank you, Elon Musk. I can't move on before I ask you what you think of this week's news that Musk said going to Mars. Do you think SpaceX is going to get to Mars?
Oh, it's definitely going to get to Mars. The question is whether it gets to Mars in one piece. You know, I love their plans. I love SpaceX's boldness in making these plans, but they do have a history of missing deadlines. In order for this Mars landing to work in 2018, there's a couple of things that need to happen. First off, the Falcon Heavy rocket has to work. You know, we still haven't seen a flight of the Falcon Heavy, and it was promised 2 years ago originally. But that's getting 27 rocket motors to work in perfect synchronization, which Musk himself described as a heavy pucker factor moment. And then you've actually got to land on Mars, which is very, very tricky. We've lost an awful lot of Mars missions because it's a really awkward planet. You've got just enough atmosphere so that when you come into land, the impact against the molecules within the atmosphere heats up any vehicle, so it needs heat shields. But the air atmosphere is also thin enough so that parachutes don't work, or at least they don't work particularly well. When Curiosity landed, NASA fired off the largest supersonic parachute ever built, and it still only slowed it down to about 1,000 miles an hour. So, you know, it's a really, really tough job. Now, the Dragon capsule, it's got, you know, it can put out a decent amount of thrust. It's got its own rocket motors. But getting there is going to require the Falcon Heavy rocket, which is as yet unflown. And actually landing on the surface is going to take an awful lot of hard work. And NASA's helping with this, but, you know, they are going to get to Mars at some point. Whether or not the 2018 mission actually gets to Mars in one piece and doesn't crater the Martian surface, that's another matter entirely.
Well, I know that Elon Musk doesn't believe in space elevators, and I've watched YouTube videos that say that they're mathematically impossible, but I still think that's a better way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can get a working space elevator, then the cost of getting into orbit drops to virtually zero, because the energy you spend going up the escalator, you can then retrieve when you come down. I personally think that space elevators are a realistic thing once we invent the materials to do them. We haven't yet got a material which can stay taut for and sort of support its own weight for 36,000 miles, which is what you need to get out to geosync orbit, or kilometers, I think. But space elevator is absolutely the logical way to go. Once you've got that, then the solar system is our oyster.
Well, I guess we know what we'll be doing this weekend, developing the material for space elevators. How hard could it be?
Well, I've got to say, I mean, my pastry is pretty hard, so we'll see.
I don't know what that means, but I'm just...
Oh no, it's cooking, you know, cooking, pastry.
Okay, got it.
My pastry is very hard.
All right, let's move on. Auto News says a new bill in Michigan would make car hacking a felony, and anyone caught doing it could spend up to a year in prison. The bill calls hacking, quote, accessing motor vehicle electronic system to destroy, damage, impair, alter, or control the vehicle, end quote. Now, I'm sure you have some thoughts on why this is a bad idea to send people to jail for hacking a car.
It's yet another example of why politicians should stay out of technology that they don't understand. I mean, this is just absolute rubbish. I mean, Charlie Miller, the guy who, one of the two guys who hacked the Fiat Chrysler Jeeps, has already pointed out that technically, if you move the steering wheel, you know, you are interacting with the car's electronic systems. But also, I'm sorry, I have a car. I drive a Prius. I bought it with my own money. I think I should have the right to actually fiddle around with the software, you know, if the mood takes me. And certainly not have to face life imprisonment if you actually, you know, if you actually are fiddling around in there. I mean, let's not forget that up until 2 or 3 years ago, people were still considering this to be a very esoteric form of hacking, which couldn't really get anywhere. And it took a couple of guys, in fact, 4 or 5, if you include the other hacking teams, to actually show quite how vulnerable these systems are before the car industry actually stood up and took notice. I interviewed Charlie Miller last year at Black Hat, and he was saying he's been to motor conventions now where people have come up and hugged him, and it was just like, thank you, at last we have an IT security budget for motor manufacturing companies. Because up until that point, that people, you know, the car makers were just like, well, no one's ever really going to do this. And it took people to actually do it, to show them and to get the consumers, get consumers worried about this, for them to take it seriously. And criminalizing research is just plain dumb. There's no two ways around it.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that, you know, the people that, like you said, that got us thinking about this, those would be the people that would go to jail for a year. It doesn't make sense.
No, I mean, I've been reading through the legislation this afternoon, and if you're a repeat offender on this one, you could go away for life. Now, I mean, we've been through this with computer security research in other areas. I mean, it used to be the case that if you pointed out to a company that there was a hole in their website, or, you know, their network was had open ports on them, the people who alerted the company about this could be, and were in some cases, prosecuted. And this law is trying to do the same again. Now, you don't get good research if you try and lock up the researchers. It just doesn't work that way. They'll just work on other areas. And, you know, Charlie Miller is an adept hacker in many ways. I'm sure there's plenty of other things he could be doing on, but he's got a thing for cars at the moment. And it makes all of us safer. So, I mean, yes, if somebody maliciously hacks your car and tries to kill you, you know, tries to kill you remotely, then fine, prosecute them. But we have laws for that. It's called attempted murder. You know, criminalizing people from poking around in the internals of their cars is just absolutely bonkers. And let's face it, because cars these days, I mean, if you've got a 2016 model car, it's basically a computer network with just four wheels and an engine attached. And there's an awful lot of stuff that can be done within that network. And we need researchers like this to show what the vulnerabilities are so that it can be locked down.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that you make a great point. We don't need, you can see where people can get anxious about it, just as they got anxious about, you know, all the flight hacking of last year, all the hackers that were saying, you know, this plane is vulnerable. People got super nervous about it for obvious reasons. But it's, again, like there are laws if you're really trying to be malicious. There are already laws for that.
Indeed. And it's interesting to see how different manufacturers deal with this. I mean, originally Chrysler would just, when I was speaking to Miller, he said that originally Chrysler were just like, yeah, well, we're aware it might be an issue, but we'll sort it out at some point. And it was only when he decided to go public with a black hat that they were actually, now we've got to fix this. And they ended up having to recall 1.4 million vehicles. Tesla, on the other hand, they also got hacked. There's a presentation on hacking Teslas. They took an entirely different approach. First off, they actually offered jobs to the people that found the security holes and actively recruited computer security experts to sort the problem out. And they pushed out honor updates as fast as they possibly could. So, you know, it's this stuff needs to be done, and motor manufacturers need to be liable for this. And they need to be a lot smarter about what the problems are within their own systems. And this, quite frankly, stupid law does nothing to help the situation whatsoever.
All right, well, moving on, The Guardian reports that Samsung has announced bedtime VR stories, a clever way to read to your child while you're out at the bar or on a business trip. You can buy a cardboard animal mask that covers the Gear VR so your child doesn't look so creepy in the Gear VR. So this is just as it sounds. You wear the goggles and your child wears the goggles somewhere else and you read your child a story. Your thoughts, Ian?
Well, I'm not a parent. I bow to your judgment on this one, but I have to say this is therapy in the making as far as I can see it. I mean, it's just like, whatever happened. I mean, my parents used to read to me when I went to bed. It was A, very important in getting me to love books and writing, but also very important for parental bonding. The idea that you can do this with a VR headset, I think is just, it's technology gone mad, for goodness sake. I mean, seriously, if you can't be bothered to read your child a bedtime story, buying them a virtual reality headset so you can do it from remotely without feeling, you know, guilty about the whole thing. I'm sorry, you should really hand in your parent card on this one. I mean, how would your kids feel if you tried this on with them?
Oh, well, they would think it was awesome, but, you know, but I think, yes, reading to your children is wonderful, and also having a job where occasionally you're not at home is also wonderful. And in that case, the highly non-technical solution to that is have other adults in your life who might be willing to read to your child, babysitter, family member, that sort of thing. I just think that this is silly, and it is totally trying to feed right into the mom guilt, which most moms I know have. I feel like, you know, children need adults that care about them in their lives. They don't need, they don't necessarily need their parent to read to them every night. And you know, just getting back to I got in trouble the other day. We were talking about VR for kids, and we posted on YouTube, and there were a lot of people who just called us old and said we had no business talking about VR. But I still think that there's no science that says how VR affects the developing brain. I tried to find some, and I couldn't find any. I know that even though the PlayStation VR isn't out yet, they've already someone uncovered like their health, and safety concerns, and they say it's not good for anyone under the age of 12. So I definitely think that VR has some great potential for PTSD and helping with the brain. But as far as just like handing it over to someone whose brain hasn't developed yet, I don't know.
No, I'm with you totally on that. I mean, it does strike me as this is like sort of a solution looking for a problem when it comes to virtual reality and kids. Obviously, kids are going to love it, but I would be kind of nervous about getting children too into VR too early. We're still only just finding out about sort of absorption, wireless signal absorption rates, effects on the brain and that sort of thing. Strapping a VR headset on a kid for long periods of time, I think I would like to see some research on it. As you say, I've been looking as well, and I can't find any research on this. A long-term epidemiological study would be very, very handy in knowing what's going on. But I think, quite frankly, just, you know, having this as a, yes, okay, we're away from home sometimes, you want to chat with your kid, but I would rather chat with my kid face-to-face on Skype than over a VR system. I just think it's more personal, more direct, and you've got to be able to see the other person directly rather than a computer animation of what they look like. And you're right also, this does tap into mom guilt and also pester power for kids. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this is marketed, because if they start marketing it to children and relying on pester power to get this stuff sold, that's going to be a major black mark on their record as far as I'm concerned.
Pester power, I like that. That's good.
it is an advertising industry term. People have written books about it. I mean, it's one of the things I dislike about the advertising industry is that there are a lot of very talented people out there, but there are a lot of people who are also very aware of psychology and are willing to use it to sell products. And pester power was first coined, I think, in the early 1980s as let's market to children, get them to pester their parents rather than try to advertise to the parents, because it's much harder for a parent to say no to their child than it is to a TV advert. So there's some, yeah, it's a very, very dark industry at times.
Well, after the break, Sam Moskovich is here to talk Nintendo and Hatsune Miku. But first, let's take a minute to thank Igloo, the sponsor of this episode. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag-and-drop widgets and a WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions like Google Drive and Dropbox. It's used by large enterprises and growing companies like BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support. So earlier this week, we reported the Nintendo news that the company had verified the codename Nintendo NX for their new gaming system, but they didn't say what kind of system it was. They also announced a date of March 2017. Sam is here to talk about this and some other news. Welcome, Sam.
Hello, hello, hello. It's good to see everyone.
It's good to see you. You have a new haircut.
I do. Well, it's... I went... I'm trying to... We'll talk about the reason why I got this segment, but I was inspired, I will say, by a revelatory robot experience. But first, we're talking Nintendo, yes?
Yes. So what were your thoughts on the announcement this week?
Well, we talked before about the fact that AMD had made some vague comments about video game systems that they were attached to coming out in the second half of 2016 and the beginning of 2017. Now we have one more piece to that puzzle with Nintendo coming forward and making it 100% clear, March 2017. That is when their next piece of hardware is going to come out. That is, coincidentally, the very end of this current fiscal year for Nintendo, meaning they are really piling everything possible into the end of the year. It's not only that, though. We also have an incredibly sparse release calendar for the company for the remaining rest of the year. This was the chance for Nintendo to let its investors know, here is everything we're going to be releasing for the next 12 months. It's bleak. The new Legend of Zelda game was the big tentpole that we were expecting for this Christmas. It was this sort of thing that everyone who owned a Wii U, even though they knew the NX was coming out, thought, well, at least I'll get this by the end of this year. Nope. That Zelda game has also been delayed, and not to March of next year, but just next year. So we honestly don't know when that Zelda game is going to come out. What we do know is that Zelda game will come out for both the Nintendo Wii U, and whatever they call the Nintendo NX. There's no name for the NX yet, so we don't know what that name is. We also were teased to say that this is neither a replacement for the Wii U nor the 3DS, but it was the phrasing that their executives at Nintendo gave for that was incredibly vague. So we really don't know whether that means it's going to, for example, tie into smartphones, whether it's going to hook into our brains, whether it's going to be a thing that you use to read virtual reality stories to your children at night. We just have no idea. It really is wide open right now. The one thing, though, is that because that has been confirmed as the late 2017 thing that AMD is releasing, that still gives us the question of, okay, well, what's the third thing that AMD was hinting at? We have no answer to that. Nintendo did not make clear at all whether that third chip is going to go into Nintendo's box as its controller-specific processor, or whether that's going to be something else. No idea, no clue. So it's bad news. And I could talk about how bad of news that is. How deep down the anti-Nintendo rabbit hole do you want me to go? Because I will put on my plumber's cap and I'll make it happen. You just tell me.
Yes, let's go down that rabbit hole, Sam.
Well, Nintendo's 3DS also doesn't have very much announced. And the 3DS is only becoming less powerful and less powerful as we go on. It's just, every time I pick up my 3DS, I feel like I'm holding this just incredibly antiquated piece of kit. Thank goodness Nintendo at least pointed to their very, very good money sales for their Miitomo app. That thing is raking in money, even though I still think it's a piece of garbage app. It's bringing people onto smartphones in a Nintendo way. I think people have been so desperate to have something that says Nintendo on their phones that they're willing to go with Snapchat Lite with little Mii characters and really crappy overpriced clothes. So that led Nintendo to saying, we have actual games that are going to come out this year, this fall, they said. One of those is in the Animal Crossing series, which is going to be perfect for smartphones because it is the kind of lifestyle simulation, as gamers know, where you check in a couple times a day. It's not about doing a whole bunch. It's about being part of a virtual community, doing a couple of little chores, interacting with neighbors. They remember little bits about you. It's perfect for that pick up, put down, check on the commute to and from work. Oh, it's just going to be a smash. Even if they do it a third as well as they did on any other system, it's going to be leaps and miles more interesting for me as far as a smartphone Nintendo product's concerned. And the other one is Fire Emblem, which has been their very successful Japanese strategy game series where you manage little troops by moving them around. So a touchscreen and moving little troops around on a map and having characters get into love stories and hate stories and rivalries should also do very well on a portable platform like a smartphone. So that is very good news. I expect Nintendo for the rest of the year to essentially focus on toys and smartphone apps because those are the things making them money. Conversely, the Nintendo Wii U, they are ramping down hard. They are kissing it goodbye. They're going to make 800,000 more Wii U's is what they said. 800,000 is what they expect to sell for the rest of the year. That's not a million. That's not separated by different territories. That's 800,000 worldwide. The Dreamcast had better numbers at the end of its run, which was basically the worst performing video game system in the past 15 years. So, woof, I have to say about the Wii U.
I have to say, I'm curious. Do you think this is? I've been hearing sort of the odd rumor coming through that this is more of they're actually going to be trying to push for a virtual reality gaming system, again tied in with smartphones. So you know, it's kind of like Gear VR or Google Cardboard. You know, something you could pop your smartphone into and then play. Have you heard any rumblings about this?
I don't see Nintendo ever ceding control of their major hardware to something like a smartphone. Now, if virtual reality were to happen, and I have not heard anything of this sort, but I wouldn't be shocked to see Nintendo clamp that sort of thing down and keep that all in-house as opposed to reaching out to third parties, I would see that being some sort of proprietary thing. I also think Nintendo really, really felt burnt after the Virtual Boy. I think that they've been very cold publicly about virtual reality, mostly because of the Virtual Boy. It was such a stinker. It led to the disgraceful exit of Gunpei Yokoi, who was the guy who created the Game Boy. Like, you can't go from high to low faster than that guy did, which was just terrible because he was just such an asset to that company. So if that's going to happen, I don't see Nintendo leading the charge, not in the virtual reality that we've seen before way. The closest I could imagine Nintendo ever doing was something that they find a different sort of tack to. You saw hints of that with augmented reality on the 3DS, where you could take the camera on it and it would recognize cards on your table and the cards would come to life and Mario would go, hey, it's a bee! And that's not really a game necessarily, but I could really see Nintendo saying, we have something that can be shared with the family, where you don't have to put a headset on or everybody's a part of it. That was their aim with the Wii U. That was their aim with the Wii, and I think that would be their aim with anything that takes reality and puts a twist on it. So augmented maybe, but until they say anything, I don't see it happening.
Well, Gadget Hog in our chat room says he loved the Virtual Boy.
Did he have Nestor's Funky Bowling? Because if so, he is a very rich man. I think that's worth a lot of money if he kept it. So you guys, you know.
Well, I realized when I would bring that up, I would not be able to follow up with anything else except, you know, because the chat room's on a little delay. But I just wanted you to know that someone out there loved the Virtual Boy, or at least claims to.
There were, I think, about 457 people in the entire world that loved the Virtual Boy, and good for them. I think they started a cult, and they all wear matching shoes.
Well, speaking of cults, last week you promised to tell us about this Hatsune Miku concert. Am I pronouncing Hatsune Miku correctly?
Hatsune Miku!
Okay. Tell us, how was it, first of all? Well, tell us what was it, first of all, for those people.
Can I just pump this glow stick the entire time? Because
yes,
that's essentially half of the experience. I did get this handy little booklet from when I went to the event. This being the anime princess who is known as a Vocaloid in all over the world. But how do I begin? It was such an incredible experience. I've never been to a concert like it. And I used to be a full-time music critic back in my olden life, in my prior redheaded life. Hatsune Miku began life in the mid-2000s as a promotion of, I cannot remember the name of the software. I bet someone in the chat room can beat me do it in like 10 seconds. But it was a special kind of software that took voice samples and voice algorithms, like real-life voice samples, and sort of algorithms of speech and vocoder kind of auto-tuning stuff to make, you could put words in and set the tune and set the tone and set everything else and make vocal performances. To promote this technology, the company in question put out a character, this blue-haired, pigtailed woman who they named Hatsune Miku, which is Japanese or something about the voice of the future. It's some sort of forward-looking kind of phrase. And not long after that, in the year 2009, they took that character, put her on a hologram at a festival in Japan, at a big one of these big pop music festivals where just it's like band after band after band after pop group after pop group. Big, huge, resounding response. People loved Hatsune Miku performing live. And in the years that have followed, this hologram rig has been upgraded in a huge way. We're not talking about the Tupac hologram where they just took a guy in the back of a room and filmed him and then just sort of broadcast it with a mirror trick. This is fully CGI rendered, or anime-ish approximation of a person dancing around in, I would say, 120 frames per second rendering, which looks really good on this giant 10-foot screen at a concert hall. And these concerts have happened in South America and Japan and other cities. And this is probably the largest North American tour that this hologram concert has ever seen. So you get, the show has a live band, in the North American case, four musicians. And you have the, as you can see on the screen, this is was in Tokyo just a few months ago. And this is almost exactly the same as what I saw. 10-foot tall screen that the crowd watches as the voice is played through speakers. Just wild. What a wild scene. Everybody has their own glow sticks. Most of these glow sticks you see here are these special, like you have to buy them from the company because all the characters have their own colors. This is not just Hatsune Miku. She has friends. She has red friend, pink friend, blue friend, the yellow twins. They have actual names. I just like to call them that. And you can change the color on the stick to show your allegiance when that character pops up. It's just wild. And it turns out most of these songs have been developed by musicians and sort of crowds. This is crowdsourced electronic music that has then been taken over by the company who puts Hatsune Miku together for this tour. Seattle had the first North American show last week on Saturday. San Francisco is getting, I believe, two concerts tomorrow, Saturday, this coming Saturday. There's an afternoon and an evening show, I think, at the same venue. I can't remember which one. But yeah, I don't even know. I feel like I'm losing track because I look at this here right now. I remember the experience of being in the concert. It was very intense. I kind of lose my head a little bit. I had a much better time than I expected.
Ian, you're in San Francisco. You could go tomorrow night.
Yeah, this looks like a deeply, deeply weird experience. I'm almost tempted. I've never come across this person before, and it was just like, it does seem like, you know, yes, we can all buy our own favorite branded glow sticks. I'm sure it would be an experience, but I'm not sure it's quite for me. It does look very weird, but...
Well, I think, don't use weird as a pejorative. There is something very intoxicating about the lighting. I thought was so impressive. That was the thing that really struck me, was when you look at this hologram on this video screen, you don't get that sense of it looking like it's a real creature up on the stage. But the way that they have the screen set off is done incredibly well. You can tell at certain moments when it's, yes, it's a screen. But for the most part, wherever you stand in the crowd, it looks like a person. The lighting is done in such a way that, like, even if it's this robot or alien thing, it's like, oh, there's really a robot or alien on the stage dancing around. They would sometimes have instruments or mic stands or other props that were lit up. I do wish that the show had more crazy stuff on that screen. This performance here is very straight. It's just a person dancing around. But other songs really went nuts. They had words pop up on the screen. One of them had little polygon effects, like sparkling all over her body. There was one in which she came out with really white skin and red eyes and black hair, and these super gothic multi-part wings sprouted from her back near the middle of the song as she floated in the sky during, like, the really epic guitar solo. It was just a candy land of bizarre. I cannot recommend enough. Call it a one-time experience. If you're the kind of person who says, I'll try anything once, try this. You really should.
I'm going to say, she does look like she's got more depth than Britney Spears, but yes.
Well, that's a good point that you make in your article, Sam, about how the record industry, like, chews up and spits out these performers in a pretty unhealthy way. I mean, and, you know, so there's something to be said about this not being an actual person.
Yeah, I think there have been commentators who've gone to the trouble of saying, well, gosh, if we're going to essentially turn music pop stars into objects, if we're going to treat people as these weird icons to be held to moral standards, I think, God, didn't Britney Spears have a purity pledge or something ridiculous like that? I mean, point, let's not act like it's weird to obsess over a robo lady instead of obsessing over Britney Spears. Let's just have some fun with the fact that there's something artificial purely for entertainment, purely for spectacle. And let's make it as robotic and bizarre and controllable as possible so that some artistry and weirdness and delight can come through without you having that sick feeling of, oh, she's going to be, you know, 25 in a few years and be discarded by the industry. You know, it's just a weird state in terms of pop music that it's a Japanese robot creature that has taken a step forward for humankind. Why not? I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, after you, Megan. Sorry.
I was going to say that I think that, you know, if you follow and play as many video games as you do, Sam, I think this is a natural extension for that. Like, that's not part of my world, so it seems weird in a good way to me. What were you going to say, Ian?
I was going to say, from a record company perspective, this is ideal, I would have thought. No more having to deal with smashed up hotel rooms, artists going on flouncing fits, oversleeping and missing the gig. You've got somebody
now
directly controlling.
You have to worry about whether the computer malfunctions. It's a blue screen of death instead of an arrest.
Whether or not you get a little window, would you like to upgrade to Windows 10 sign coming up on the stage?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. Thank you for telling us all about it. And I'm sure there's some graduate thesis in the making here that can probably figure out whether this is really right or really wrong. I don't know.
A little of both.
Yeah, that's good.
No, it's fun. It's a spectacle. If you can go for any reason. I actually had a reader who said, would this be appropriate for my 10-year-old? I said, this would be one of the best things to take a 10-year-old to because it'll be so weird. You will be the coolest mom or dad. Just go. Yeah.
Okay. That's good advice because I have 3 children who are big anime fans. So I think that they would like it. Well, thank you so much, Sam. As always, you can find Sam's work at ArsTechnica.com, including a great piece on how you can use a Chromecast to make a cheap Sonos. You synchronized your Chromecast. It was awesome. I wanted to spend more time talking about the cyber lady, as you call her. So we are not going to delve into that today, but you can check that out at Ars Technica. And you can also find Sam at Sam Red on the Twitter.
That's true. And I will be on your channel on Sunday, I believe, for my first ever Sunday afternoon appearance on twit.tv. So I'm looking forward to that, and I'll see everybody
marvelous.
Soon.
It was great fun.
Well, I heard rumors, but I knew they would discover you eventually, but I guess
they told me I had to completely redo my image. They're very superficial over there at Leo's show. I don't know what his problem is, but that'll be it.
All right. Well, then we'll see you on Sunday, Sam.
Bye, guys.
Take care. So Jim from Wisconsin took me up on my offer to express love for your cable company, if there was such a thing as love for one's cable company. Jim writes, I have Charter for both TV and internet. I live 5 miles from either of 2 small towns, 100 miles from the Twin Cities. Over the air is nearly impossible. Back in the 50s, my grandfather was a cable pioneer. He erected towers and strung wires and charged $1 a month so he could sell TVs. I have switched out boxes and modems and have instant support. Any outages have been handled very satisfactorily. Had spotty outages for a time. They were here at 8:30 p.m. checking signal at the house. They were in the ditch checking signal 7 days a week and ended up digging a new wire to the house and followed up to see if that fixed it. Thank you, Jim. I thought I would read his email because sometimes we all need to be reminded to appreciate the little things in life when our cable company does something good for us. After the break, particle accelerator versus weasel. Who will win? But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. With advancement in technologies, we have smart cars and smartphones and smart homes. And smart cyber ladies, losing your possessions can make you feel less than smart. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. The coin-sized device locates misplaced keys, wallets, computers, even pets in seconds. Pair Tracker to your iOS or your Android device. Attach it to anything via the key loop or the adhesive and find its precise location with the tap of a button. It's that easy. If you lose your phone, you can press the button on the tracker and your phone rings even when your phone is on silent. The Tracker Bravo is constructed with beautiful anodized aluminum for the thinnest and most durable tracking. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map even if it's miles away. If an item goes missing, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. When another Tracker user comes within 100 feet of your lost item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is. Tracker recently introduced Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. Save time and energy by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you will instantly get an answer. No need to search. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Right now, Tracker is having a Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd only with their best prices ever. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get the free color upgrade. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT. And TNT's fan of the day is Trenton Moody on Twitter. Trenton watches enough of our shows to know what a fan I am of face-swapping apps, as long as they're not racist. Moody apparently watches TNT while swapping his face with mine. I think he looks really great. I might try his haircut. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. So, CERN's Large Hadron Collider was shut down today. Was it hacked, Ian? Was it blown up? What can you tell us about this?
Well, it was a mammalian hack, but basically what happened was that, and this literally just came up in the day's briefing that they gave at CERN, a beech martin, which is a weaselly type creature, sort of long, thin mammal, nice, sharp, pointy teeth, took a liking to one of the power cables and bit through a 66-volt line around about section number 8 of the Large Hadron Collider and became toast, quite literally. you don't really muck about with that much voltage when you're the size of that and you're not grounded. So what it's done, it's actually disabled the line. It may have caused shorts further on down the system. And they're now going to have to take the entire multi-billion dollar project offline for 2 weeks while they check to see exactly what's been buggered about with this incident, and to make sure that the remaining systems have got enough power, because one of the line it bit through controls the chilling system, and you've got to get the interior of the Large Hadron Collider down to very low temperatures for it to work at its best abilities. So this has been quite an unusual one, but not the first time wildlife has put the LHC out of commission.
Yeah, you broke another story a while back about a bird that dropped a baguette. Was that the same?
Indeed. Well, we never managed to find out if it was a baguette, but a bird in 2009. It was weird. We got a report from a reader who monitors the LHC on a fairly obsessive basis, saying there've been some unexplained power surges. You should give them a call about this. And as it turns out, one of our chaps was actually at the LHC having a guide round, and they said yes, there was a problem in that a bird had stolen a piece of bread from the CERN cafeteria. As it was flying away, it had dropped it onto a power substation, and that had created a short which knocked out which caused this massive power surge which knocked out the entire instrument. So it's always worth remembering that these little things, the birds and the mammals, that can really derail something like this. It's the law of unintended consequences. But for this particular creature, then yes, it was end of story. Although, this being the internet, he does now have his own Twitter account and is threatening revenge.
What's his handle?
I think it's CERN Weasel, which was, and he's just going, I'm not dead. They're lying. I will have my revenge unless my demands are met. And just, I've just retweeted one of his tweets. It's one of the things you've got to love about social media is that literally within hours of this poor rodent getting electrocuted, somebody is taking their photo and sticking it up on a Twitter handle and having some fun with it. It's the same kind of people that gives us sarcastic rover for the Curiosity rover on Mars and various other parody accounts.
Yes, we'll be entertained by this for probably maybe even more 48 more hours or something, and then we'll move on to the next weasel.
Yeah, I know. Something new will come up, I'm sure. I saw one report that apparently in Illinois, at one of the particle smashes there, some raccoons got in there and what was described as a concerted attack. And you're like, and as a Brit over here, I am freaked out by raccoons because it's just, I'm sorry, rodents should not have five fingers. They shouldn't be that fearless about human beings. Literally, if they get flint and steel worked out, then humanity is in serious trouble. when it comes to raccoons, trash pandas, whatever you want to call them, then, you know, they are just scary, scary creatures, and I want nothing to do with them.
Well, it's good to know. If you ever cross me, I know how to get you back, I guess.
Aha, great. That's always nice to know. Awesome. Come up to do a show one day and come back and there's a raccoon staring in the bin in my rearview mirror looking menacing. It's like, yeah, that would have me swerving off the road. They've even got the little burglar masks. I mean, it's just, you know.
It's true. They're not cute raccoons. Well, Ian, thank you so much. I feel like the news was tailor-made for you today.
It's been a lot of fun, certainly. We've had the interesting, the outrageous, the weird. It's all been a very good routine.
Right. When you can talk about space elevators and raccoons in the same show, you know it's a good one.
Yeah, exactly. A good wide range, certainly.
Well, Ian Thompson is at the Register, and you can also find him on Twitter where he's retweeting the weasels the famous weasels of the day. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you, Megan.
Take care.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Well, tomorrow's guest, Monday's guest, will be Mike Murphy from Quartz. TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leaving us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV. You can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/TNT and subscribe to the Twit newsletter at twit.tv/newsletter. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney. Jason Howell will be back on Monday. And thank you to Kara, our technical director, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for sticking around and talking tech with us. We will see you on Monday.